RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Boy, it comes around quick. Wednesday here at RCR and everywhere else. Of course, Wednesday is Legal Hub. Katie Ashby-Coppins, our ace lawyer, is back with us. Katie, good to have you back again.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. And thank you to all your listeners. And yes, I'm a lawyer in New South Wales in Australia and head of legal Voices for Freedom in New Zealand.
That's totally correct. And boy, you must work hard.
Yeah, I think a lot of us do, you know.
I just see the output, man. I tell you.
Oh, no, if I tell you what, it's exhausting and there's just so much and it comes at you all the time. Yeah. So I've actually got a bit of a call out to the listeners today too during our RCR.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm curious because I know I mentioned a day or two ago when we're talking about the senselessness, I can never get that right, submissions closed midnight Tuesday, so last night.
Mm-hmm.
And you tried to get an extension on that, but that didn't work out. What happened there?
Yeah, I did. So I had only this going senselessness, that's the manual completing of the census,
yep.
And just simply relying, I guess, on different registers and the
admin data, they call it.
Yes, Stats New Zealand going in and grabbing your information from various departments and perhaps where it may lead commercial businesses and the like. I wrote to them and said, okay, no, it opened on the 8th. We weren't aware of it till recently. I mentioned it only recently on the radio. It would be great to get an extension of time for more people to provide feedback on this very important issue, which really goes to the questions of trust in Stats New Zealand to collect this information and how content you feel or people feel about Stats New Zealand just grabbing your information and data from everywhere. And I think it's a really important question because a lot of the departments that they're going to be collecting information from, you have a unique identifier.
Yeah.
What they'll be doing is they'll be identifying you as one unit as opposed to, you know, your tax file number being different from your health number, being different, say, from your maybe shopping account number when you go to the supermarket and flag your flybys. They seem to be wanting to make one big, huge database. So how do you feel about that? Do you feel content? Do you have faith that they're going to do good things with your data and your personal private information, especially when you haven't willingly given it? And I know the sellers is, oh, it'll make it so much easier for you. Mm. But it's like anything. If it's easier, it's not necessarily in your best interest because that's the sell.
Yeah, it's always the sell. We know that now. Mm.
So that's my call out to people. If you do come across these things, please email inbox at realitycheck.radio and let us know what they are because there is so much. It's really hard to keep across all of it. And then just say, hey, guys, I think Katie might want to know about this from Legal Hub because we're always keen to write feedback and encourage people to do so. And Legal Hub is the perfect opportunity to hear some thoughts on it.
Yeah. And we found out from Len Cook, the former government statistician who was on yesterday, when we were talking about the Data and Statistics Act now, the normal authority of the head of stats and whoever's delegated under that person in Stats NZ can delegate out to other departments now the kind of same use of those stats that would normally be siloed out to only stats. So the two are related, aren't they?
They are, and I think you're going to see it's just a step in the progression of allowing banking data, supermarket data, and possibly telecommunications data being fed into these massive stat registers.
Cars are taking data now, and they're going to be using that to do charging for roads in the future, won't they?
That's correct. So. Yeah, look, and it's all part and parcel. It is part of the bigger picture. And these are just the Lego blocks that are connecting up.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for trying to get the extension. I might have missed it. Did they give you a legitimate reason why the submission period couldn't be extended? And because it was a bit under the radar, it was stealthy. I mean, if you didn't know about it.
Wasn't it? Well, look, I am going to go back and send an OIA asking them where all the places where they published it. I've now signed up to the to get emails from Stats New Zealand. It is a bit of death by emails because I already am signed up to so many things. So it is a case where I'm calling out people to actually help and support too because of the sheer volume of work. Yeah, look, I just wrote to them and asked for a short extension of a couple of weeks because we'd just learned about it. And the response back was that consultation had been open for quite some time, nearly 6 weeks, which is the standard length of time for a government agency public consultation. And they insisted that the response needed to be with them by 5 p.m. yesterday. So that was the extent of the information. So I've gone back to them and asked to be put on their media list and also have signed up to things, but I'll probably also send an OIA to confirm all of the other places they say they published and let people know. Because I think that that's really relevant as well.
Well, 6 weeks. Sorry. If it's not widely distributed to the obvious places, not many people are going to see it. Unless
they're correct.
Enthusiasts, you know, or something.
Yeah, correct. And look, the 6 weeks comment is really important for the next one I want to quickly touch on.
Okay, so you didn't get that through, but there has been an extension to something else. What is it?
Well, no, I didn't get the other one through either. I'm sorry. Last Wednesday, we talked about the inquiry into climate adaption, and we were on with Sean Rush.
Yep.
Goodness gracious, he's awesome. Talking about the inquiry into climate adaption and the opportunity to give feedback on that closed on Sunday night. And I think Alia sent something out for Voices for Freedom, encouraging everyone to complete their feedback.
Yep.
I actually wrote to the committee secretary, Secretariat of the Finance and Expenditure Committee, asking for an extension of time because they'd only given us 2.5 weeks to give feedback. And remember, we just heard from Stats New Zealand saying 6 weeks is the ordinary time frame.
Oh, yeah, good spotting. Yeah.
So they've said that it was 3.5 weeks, I think, they'd given us. Not 2.5, forgive me.
And still,
they
a lot less, yep.
They discussed it and considered it, and the committee declined to extend the general submission deadline for the inquiry into climate. They have given Reality Check Radio short extension, so today by 2 p.m. I should have our feedback filed on the topic. That's just a really good reminder. If you are getting up against time, request an extension yourself personally, and often you're granted one personally. They might not necessarily grant it for a overall overall group. So,
but you've got to ask, right? You've got to ask.
Yeah, you could certainly ask. And we've seen from the Kapiti Calm Girls that the inquiries have been, again, limited publication of them so that, you know, in the first example that they'd given, I think it was all very pro consultants saying this is a wonderful thing and climate adaption's real and you must allow us to write our questionable reports on all of these issues. Hmm. So look, that's just a snapshot on the inquiries.
Okay. There does seem to be a pattern here of kind of under the radar and, in this latest case, sort of rush, just saying, just could be me.
Look, you know, they do talk about how that things are published on Beehive, RNZ, News Hub, Scoop, The Post, LGNZ website. I personally probably don't follow enough of those. And so, again, it's really for our callers.
Well, they have to take into account the detachment from mainstream media. It's significant.
Correct. And so I've expressly asked them to put us on their media list so that if they send a press release out for this in the future, then
Should know we're there.
Well,
I suppose you got to.
They now know. Yeah. And it's an express request.
All right. Moving on. What next for the 2024 IHRs here in little old NZ? Where are we at on that? Because I've got all these facts and figures and this happened, that happened, and these countries voted and they didn't. And we've even heard that, that there was coercion to make people vote in a particular way by holding the return air ticket back.
Yeah, I'm not sure about those
things.
So
help me out here. Help me out here. Boil it down. Where are we at?
So the IHR amendments were a watered-down version that were adopted in the very last or final moments of the World Health Assembly in Geneva on the 1st of June. So that was the last day. Let's not forget they were supposed to be delivered to us 4 months beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
In accordance with Article 55, they didn't do that. Instead, they failed to reach agreement by the Friday, the 24th of May, which was before the World Health Assembly started. And then they got a new drafting group in to beat the IHRs into shape a little bit more. And they ended up with quite a whittled down version of what they had originally proposed, but not too dissimilar from the April 2024 versions that were published. And it was interesting in that, you know, a lot of people were getting upset that there was, you know, the vote wasn't a 50% consensus for the IHRs to get across the line. And look, there wasn't a formal vote. People didn't put their hands up. The WHO says that themselves. But there were sufficient enough countries in the room at the time, and only a few spoke up. And I think only one, possibly two, were not too happy with the adoption, but otherwise everyone else stayed pretty quiet. I think Costa Rica might have got a bit excited and says they weren't stringent enough. So who knows?
What? Okay, what's going on there?
By the by, let's just work on the basis that the the IHR amendments 2024 got across the line, and so now that effectively starts the time ticking for New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the time ticking for New Zealand to consider the amendments. And because we rejected last year the shortened timeframes, we now have 18 months to consider any of the amendments and reject those within the 18 months, which I think is November 2025. And if silence is acceptance, and if we don't reject them, then we have to have implemented the changes by 2024.
Okay. Right.
And so that's the timeframe. We've, of course, got a requirement under the NZ First National Coalition Agreement that a national interest assessment will be held to review these documents. And that national interest assessment looks like it's held by the Minister of Finance, who I'm sure would want to know that this is going to cost us billions of dollars. But of course, the WHO are not talking about that and quite how much that's going to cost.
I don't know if that'd be enough to stop someone, though, because
there is significant, interesting things happening at the moment, particularly with the rejection of, or particularly given that they didn't get resolution on the pandemic treaty. There's much to be said over this time, and you bet your bottom dollar we'll be certainly saying it. And we can be referring to things like the University of Leeds peer review report, which indicates that the pandemic readiness cost is based on a circular lie between the central bank, the WHO, and whoever else is getting involved with being an area that's quoted regularly. And then likewise, we've got the situation where the risks of naturally occurring pandemics is very low.
Yeah, I see they say that in that report.
Yes, in the second report, they certainly do. So yeah, two really important reports. People that do not have money in the game are writing these reports. Consider where you get your information from. You know,
yeah.
Who's backing this?
Yeah, there's a huge disproportionate estimate, COVID versus tuberculosis and malaria. It's just so glaring, yet the latter two are far more of a problem to the world population.
Mm. Yes, proportionality is lacking.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, yeah. Okay, so everyone's got a breathing space, so everything that happens to, I don't know, pull out of this, not buy into it, it's got to happen in that time frame.
Yes, correct. And look, they might try and bring it forward a little bit further, but we are doing a lot to find out when the national interest assessment will be held, whether there'll be public opportunity to give public feedback on the IHR amendments. And yeah, it's something we'll keep our finger on the pulse on. But for the meantime, We now need to consider what it means for the domestic situation as in New Zealand.
Right. I'm not hearing, I would have expected to hear someone because it was, okay, it might not have been covered extensively at all by mainstream media at the time, 3 weeks ago, but I would have expected to hear some kind of reassuring words like, well, now we've got this amount of time and da 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 da. Nothing.
Nothing.
Why? I know you just got to ask. Why? It's obviously not perceived as an issue that affects enough of a voter base to be worth sticking your neck out for, is what I'm thinking.
There has been an incredible amount of silence around these things. And I will just say, look who pays for that media.
Yeah. Brought to you by Pfizer.
Brought to you by Pfizer. And look, it's a pay-use model. We used to pay 50 cents for the Herald, and it used to be delivered to your doorstep because you were the person paying for it. The media landscape is very different now, and the media will, mainstream media will talk to or play the drum of that who is paying.
Yeah, because let us not forget that New Zealand, along with the United States, the only country apart from the US that allows pharmacy medicines to be promoted in advertising, as I understand it. And I imagine that they're probably the big spenders with the mainstream, particularly TV, mainstream channels.
Yes, absolutely. And we did an OIA request around the amount of money that pharmaceutical companies were paying stuff and the like. So I'd have to go back and track that down. It also might be a situation where it's a public-private payment and might not necessarily be directly through from a pharmaceutical company to one of the mainstream media outlets. So that's the other thing to keep in mind. It might be a payment through some other means that's not necessarily as obvious or OIA-able.
You don't want to lose the revenue if you're carrying the advertising.
No. And look, in New Zealand, the advertising is a lot different to in the States when it comes to pharmaceutical advertising, but it's still there. But, you know, just reflect on the last few years, I think that there was a lot of statements from the podium of truth which probably breached even New Zealand's advertising rules for medicine or pharmaceuticals.
That was different, Katie. That was an emergency situation. Okay.
Yes, I'm not sure parliamentary privilege extends to that situation. So we will wait to see.
When I was in the States in January this year, I sat down in the motel room. We had a kind of a free evening. And I thought, I wonder what's on. So I turned it on. And it was one of the channels out of Los Angeles or something. And it was wall-to-wall pharma advertising. Wall-to-wall. And I couldn't even imagine how many products had been thought up. There was stuff for everything.
Yeah.
Stuff I'd never even heard of, you know, irritability of this, that, just one after the other. Crikey.
And then the side effects, because they've got to list them under their advertising rules in the States.
You can't read them, though. They're too small.
Well, no, the funny one was this. When I was last in the States, a pill for restless leg syndrome existed.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know what the side effects were?
Oh, restless leg.
No, it could cause gambling and alcoholism.
Oh,
and I'm
right.
Like, well, you get rid of your restless legs.
How do they
but you might end
that?
Up being a, well, because it must be a pseudo something or other. So it must just feed that part of your.
You don't want to be too close to Vegas taking that.
I was like, maybe you should go for a run. Well, maybe that's how you get rid of your restless legs going to the
well, it's making use of your restless leg. You have to have two restless legs for that to work. Okay, so does that square that up?
Yeah, look, I'm going to be banging on about the IHR amendments for a long time yet. So rest assured, we will keep you up to date with those and any opportunities to give feedback and be involved.
All right, to the people's terms, Katie, and the reason that I'm thinking of this is because I saw some sort of release from Tony Blakely, one of the commissioners of the COVID-19 inquiry. He was referencing Rory Nairn in there and was talking about, understanding more for the next pandemic and stuff like that, which I thought was a bit predictable and not what I wanted to hear. But anyway, so where are we at with the, how many? 30,000 signatures in a petition that went to Parliament that you guys delivered on the doorstep. So what is the status of that petition now?
Yeah, so you'll recall that we had the opportunity or were asked by the current Royal Commission to provide suggested feedback on extended terms and provide stories. And so we helped people to answer those questions themselves by, you know, thinking about some or giving them some extended terms they might like to think about. But we also drafted a full set or suite of the people's terms, which would be a response or answer to a full inquiry if we were to ask all of the questions. So you'll know under the current inquiry that there, one, it's limited in scope, but two, there's some specific subjects that are excluded, like the the way that the virus moved on from, you know, Wuhan to Omicron and onwards, and also vaccine efficacy is excluded.
I can't believe that, man. I'm sorry. I can't believe that it's that's the one.
It's incredible. It's incredible. It makes a farce out of the current Royal Commission. So look, we drafted some terms, help them out, not let them worry about too much thinking, and suggested that people just reference or write to the commissioners saying, look, we want the people's terms to become the terms of inquiry in a full inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so separately to that process, we also lodged the people's terms as a petition with the petitions committee. And we said, hey, look, over 33,000 people have signed up to these people's terms. They really want the Commission of Inquiry to be a full inquiry, answering all the questions that New Zealanders deserve to have answers to, because this has been the most craziest thing to happen in peacetime New Zealand. And we were asked for the opportunity to submit feedback on those terms. And we did. That went in yesterday to the Petitions Committee. And I think that the submissions will be made available. It was a really neat thing to be able to sit there and submit why the people's terms should be the new terms for any inquiry, and also to explain why it was necessary for the current inquiry to be terminated and a new one started in full, so as to give all of New Zealanders comfort and trust that the process is not a farce. And I think I might have even used the words kangaroo court.
Okay. I was just thinking, it's like in a road accident, the guy behind the wheel who's just wiped someone out stinks of alcohol, but we're not going to check for that.
That is a very good analogy. Thank you, Paul. It's a forward-focused inquiry, this one, and noteworthy in Professor Blakely, who was the chair of the Commission of Inquiry, his newsletter, if you want to call it that, that came out last Friday, he was very quick to mention bird flu.
That's right. I missed that. Yeah.
And he's probably itching at the bit on bird flu as well, because I think he's based in Australia now.
So more like appearances, more fees, more rock star kind of opportunities.
Well, no, the whole Royal Commission's about future pandemics. So let's just go to highlight that there's another one just around the corner.
Yeah. But, I mean, they all get coverage. You know, they become the soothsayers and the disseminators of information. And, you know, the next thing you know, they're doing sort of silly things on TV.
Yeah. Well, look, Professor Blakely's in a world of trouble, I'd say, and I think he should be recused from the commission, because even under Labor's current terms, he's conflicted and shouldn't be making decisions and certainly shouldn't be the chair. So I think with the resignation of Theon Parata last year in December, it's really a good chance to, you know, let Blakely go and to start again.
All right, Katie, well, thank you for bringing us up to date there now. But wait, there's more. Last week, was it, you caught up with Dr. David Bell recently here for WHO and UOW event in Auckland, and he's out of the country now, but you've chatted with him kind of around what we've been talking about in terms of World Health Assembly, IHRs, et cetera. So we're going to hear a couple of clips from that. So thanks for coming in live this morning. We'll hear a few excerpts from your conversation with David. We'll get David back on and do a more thorough chat with him. But that's coming up in just a moment. And we'll do Legal Hub again in a week. How about that?
That sounds like a deal. Thank you so much. Thank you very much to all your listeners. It's such a pleasure to be here. I hope you find it useful. I certainly enjoy catching up.
So now you'll hear some excerpts from what we were just talking about, Katie and I. And that was an interview that Katie conducted with David Bell just a day or so ago, titled A World Health Assembly Debrief. And the first excerpt was about what was adopted at the 77th World Health Assembly almost a month ago. Who goes along to vote on behalf of our countries and financing?
The pandemic agreement or treaty was due to be delivered on the 31st of March. It wasn't, but then that's been postponed, which is sensible. So there's another 12 months now to negotiate that. The IHR amendments, the International Health Regulations, Article 55, Paragraph 2, says very clearly that they need to be an amendment that is going to be voted on needs to be available to countries 4 months before a vote. And the reason for that is because these things have implications for health, for budgets, for human rights, etc. They're complicated. Countries need time to look at these. And they were delivered, it's about a day before. So, and this was pointed out, and the WHO made some very ridiculous excuses, including, which is telling because these are international organizations, you expect them to be measured and honest and follow common sense and legal procedure. And this is one of the problems that we're facing, that people assume the WHO wouldn't do stupid stuff. So they said that because the original amendments, which are completely different to what we're looking at now, were delivered about 18 months earlier, when the negotiations obviously started, that therefore the 4 months was fulfilled, which is, is just silly. And it says a lot about the whole process that we're facing. Mm. So the original proposals are completely different in many aspects to what they're voting on now. That's why you have a negotiating process. And what you're voting on is what you're supposed to actually review and decide whether you support or not. So, it's like introducing a law into the Australian Parliament and then negotiating for 6 months and then pretending that nothing has changed and that you're voting on the original thing. So, they broke the legal requirements in having the vote. It's interesting that I think only one country really raised this, and the vote went ahead anyway. And I think that says a lot about the situation we're in with, as you said, politicians are completely unaware of what is going on. They assume organizations like the World Health Organization, the World Bank, IMF, etc., who are all behind this, that they are run in a way that is objective and honest and for the good of countries, and they're quite unaware of the changes that have taken place over the last couple of decades, where they're now very much aligned with quite narrow but powerful business interests. Money speaks. And so we're seeing a business agenda to make a lot of money out of the world's population being pushed through these organizations. And I think politicians are quite unaware. They don't understand who is being represented.
Mm. And, you've picked up on something. Politicians don't know what's going on. So who's making the decisions? If you've got a situation where you've got representatives from Australia turning up at Geneva, who is actually getting the chance to make these decisions? Do they go with an authority? Do they have a mandate? How can they be representative if, one, the politicians don't know and most of the citizens don't?
So in the end, the countries vote on these big policy issues at the World Health Assembly. So you can say the countries are voting, but they trust the WHO to present, to guide them in this. The WHO is, its funding now, it's changed over the years. It was originally core funded WHO got money, they decided based on what countries asked for and disease burden, et cetera, where they would put their work. And it was on, you know, large burden diseases that kill most people and that you can do something about. Over the last 20 years, it's changed dramatically. About 80% of the funding now is specified, which means the funder gives the money to WHO for a specific purpose designated by the funder. So the WHO is a tool for the funder. They're not like a non-government organization. They do, you know, the government gives them money if they do something. So they're a tool of funders. So they're doing the work of the funders day to day for 80% of their budget. And about 20 to 25% of that budget is private. And the largest other funders are, you know, it's been the US and Germany, which are very large pharmaceutical manufacturers as nations. So Germany was behind BioNTech, behind Pfizer, etc. So they are very much, their day-to-day work is on vested interests. The people that know where their salaries come from, which is these vested interests. So countries to a large extent are led by what they're told in the rooms by the WHO, etc. There's also, I mean, we have to be realistic that our governments spend a lot of time at Davos every year. They are very close to these very wealthy corporations for the obvious reasons that these corporations also sponsor media and are very influential in funding politicians, so funding campaigns, etc. globally. So they have a big influence on whether a politician will get back into office, unfortunately, rather than what people think. Especially the control of the media, I think, is very important. You mentioned that the media are hardly touching this subject, even though it's so fundamental to our lives. So it's a complicated situation where we have a sort of very large corporate authoritarian movement by large financial institutions and large corporations, particularly pharma, that are using the WHO and influencing significant levels of government. And behind this, there's a huge ignorance on the level of risk of what they're talking about. And we've seen direct misrepresentation of the risks of outbreaks and pandemics, etc., which in terms of mortality are a tiny percentage of what makes people die. But looking at the media, you'd think it's an existential threat to all of us. And they're even writing that, even though it's their own data, the WHO, World Bank, etc., that are behind this. Their own data says otherwise. So there's a huge lack of awareness of what we're actually dealing with, of the risk of outbreaks compared to other diseases that the WHO used to concentrate on. There's also a lack of awareness even of how much money is being asked here. They'd be asking about 10 times the current WHO budget for this. Yet in Geneva, in the negotiations, as far as I've seen, the issues of budget haven't even come up. So countries are committing themselves to enormous amounts of money, not even counting when WHO declares a pandemic and then there's requirements to give even more. But again, politicians are completely unaware of this, by and large, and are not talking about it. So I think it's part of an erosion of sovereignty and of democratic process that, you know, is not just the WHO. The WHO is being used as a tool by a much larger process of undermining Western democracies and what we thought day-to-day life was. But this is, for the last year or so, this has been one of the obvious examples of it.
Dr. David Bell. And we're playing excerpts from an interview Katie Ashby-Coppins did with David Bell re the 77th World Health Assembly. The next excerpt concerns voting and surveillance.
David, if we could have a bit of a talk about the voting process. As I understand it, we had a situation where neither working group got the pandemic treaty or the international health regulations done by the Friday, the 24th. They then go in to start and talk about that on the Tuesday, I think it was the 27th of May, and they decide that there needs to be a new drafting group, which seems to be different or not all the same as the other working groups that have spent the last 2 years on negotiating these documents. Really, I guess I interpret it as a bit of a bully boy technique to get countries together. Could be wrong. But then, you know, further work and further drafting work was done until they had what looked like a quite different but possibly a little bit wrung out version of the international health regulations that ended up being tabled on Saturday night on the 1st of June. Could you just let us know a bit more about the inner workings of that and how, you know, it seems quite an extraordinary situation?
Yeah, it's extraordinary given that these are legally binding documents on countries. It comes under international law, the IHR. And so normally, I mean, as you said, you'd have a considered, sensible process of going through them and discussing them. So, yeah, I mean, they didn't have the 4 months. It means that the people voting weren't fully aware of the implications at all of what they were voting on. The process itself was, you know, in terms of the World Health Assembly, was legitimate. There's 109 countries represented. There's just 4 reservations from 4 different countries. 2 countries said they would wait and see because they have elections coming up and their governments are changing. So it had the 50% backing that is required for the IHR amendments. So, and now we face, there is 10 months, for most countries it's 10 months within which they can reject any or all of the amendments, in which case the former international health regulations apply. So, and then, you know, after that, 2 months later, they will come into force. So I think a lot of the focus now needs to be on having countries reject some or all of these amendments. And as you said, the pandemic agreement or treaty, there will be another up to 12 months, but it may well be less, to negotiate a number of issues that couldn't be agreed in the time of the World Health Assembly. And they would probably change the leadership, they'll change some of the constituents. So a lot of the pushback on that, and the reason there wasn't agreement, is because a lot of the people in the room negotiating were pretty sensible people and aware of the implications and concerns. And that is one of the main reasons why they didn't reach agreement. So it will be interesting to see how the process changes and whether there is an attempt to restructure things in order to have less debate and, you know, airing of views in the future process.
Does it sound very democratic?
Well, we'll see. People have been saying this is, it's democratic in that countries in the end are there to negotiate. And this is an interesting question. People are saying that there should be much more direct input into the WHO. I differ. I don't think there should, because we are emphasizing the importance of national sovereignty, which is the expression of democracy. And if you start having a lot of direct input into an organization like the World Health Organization, then it starts to usurp governments, which is exactly what we're trying not to do. I think the important thing here is that governments push back and say this is unacceptable. The WHO is their servant, after all, and not their master. And if anything is there which is not in their interest, then they should not be agreeing to it. So I think the emphasis needs to be on pushing our governments to ensure that these processes are appropriate and that national interests are paramount.
Mm, absolutely. And that's what we will be doing and spending a lot of work on in the next wee while, to make sure that our governments are aware of this and that we're not happy about them. One of the things I saw on the WHO website today had seen in, I think, in one of the videos was the point of whether or not there was an official vote on Saturday, the 1st of June, about these international health regulation amendments. And the WHO themselves has come out today or yesterday. Were all state parties required to agree on the IHR amendments for them to be adopted? Is abstention considered agreement? And the answer they've given is the package of amendments was adopted by consensus without a vote by the 77th World Health Assembly on the 1st of June. The amendments will come into force for all state parties, except for those state parties that may notify the Director General of a rejection or reservation within the set deadline. The comment about it being adopted by consensus without a vote, can you help us understand that a little bit more? Because it did require a majority. Did it require a majority of the 194 countries?
So it did. There are about 45 speakers, I think, or 48 speakers before the adoption, and they represented about 109 countries. It includes the EU representing 27 countries. Ethiopia represented 48, the African Union plus Egypt. So, and that is an accepted way. You know, there's an acceptance that although in the end it's a country vote, they can vote or they can present in regional blocks. So there are 109 countries that indicated that they were supportive. And then it was adopted, and there was an opportunity for countries to give reservations or say no, and there are only four reservations and two deferred. So this out of 196, there's 194 in the World Health Assembly, there's two other states that are part of the International Health Regulation. So there is an indication from a majority of that 196 that there was support, and there was a time, an opportunity to reject them and speak against, and that was barely taken up. So in terms of acceptance that the countries represented in the room, that there was enough and that they were overall in favour, I think that's, WHO is correct in that.
Okay. And that is acceptable.
That is acceptable. That's pretty standard practice for UN. In the end, the countries can speak up if they want to. They're supposed to be sovereign states.
Oh, very interesting. That's certainly been a question I think a lot of us have had. So I think the timeframes now is that these international health regulations, as they currently are, and we'll get into the subject matter of them a bit closer shortly, but the international health regulations as they are, I presume they've been delivered out to all of the countries, and that 10-month timeframe to reject them has started for all of the countries, but for, I think, Estonia, Iran, New Zealand, and was it Ethiopia?
No, there's one other. Yeah, there's four countries.
Israel.
There's four countries that rejected an amendment 2 years ago that shortened the review time from 18 months to 10 months.
But Australia is not in that. So Australia has 10 months to reject those amendments. So that takes us through to really the end of March 2025. Fortunately, we do have an election in that period of time. And then there's also a requirement to implement the amendments into our domestic legislation by May 2025. So within a year from the vote. One of the new bodies that has been brought into existence into the international health regulations is it an NIH authority? Yes, the National IHR Authority. Is that a new entity which Australia is going to have to establish to ensure, you know, compliance? And how's that going to be? Is that how, I guess, they... WHO supersedes the sovereignty concerns because they've now got a body inside Australia effectively working and operating?
It is a person or a entity that will sort of represent the interests of the WHO in terms of the international health regulations within the country, coordinate on behalf of the WHO. So it's still under the government, but it is... that they want a focal point that they can talk to directly, and that will report to them and As Robin mentioned, there's a very strong surveillance network here, and this is why, you know, I think in a way most of it got through that they want. The guts of it got through, the problem got through, which is that we are setting up a huge surveillance network. It's massively disproportionate to the problem and massively expensive in terms of finance and human resources, that is going to look for and find viral variants, because this is completely normal. We're seeing at the moment with bird flu, suddenly we find bird flu genome in milk, in sewage, in whatever. It's carried by wild birds. Of course it's there. But if we look for it, we will find it. So we're setting up this huge surveillance network that will allow this constant fear-mongering around the threat of outbreaks and pandemics to be pushed over and over again. And because they just need a threat and not an actual outbreak, they can then declare, they can go down the road, which they're talking about now with bird flu, of restrictions, locking people down, the sort of stuff we saw in COVID, and then a mRNA 100-day vaccine, which will give you your freedom back and generate hundreds of billions of dollars for the people who are behind this whole process in the end. So the surveillance network is the key to this whole industry happening. It provides the sort of the fear on which they can push this whole agenda and make huge amounts of money from taxpayers and ordinary people. So that has got through. It's Annex 1 of the IHR amendments. It was very strongly, very heavily beefed up in the amendments. And the authority that you're talking about will be one of the, will be a key body in ensuring that that happens. The WHO will have a mechanism to probably every 2 years inspect countries and give a list of things that they need to improve in terms of surveillance, etc. Which is very much like the, it's modelled on the, I think the Office for Human Rights, which has a similar mechanism. So countries will be inspected and they'll be required to maintain this very high level of surveillance, to report within 24 or 48 hours to WHO of any potential threat. And the entity that that you're talking about, the focal point, will be the entity that does that. And you know, we're giving WHO the power then to put in all these recommendations, which, as we saw in COVID, will be followed. And the original amendments had requirement to follow, so that's been, the wording has been softened. Mm-hmm. But in a way, that's almost window dressing, because we know that with the power of, you know, the big financial institutions and the media, etc., that governments and politicians, except for a very few large countries, are actually left with very little choice but to comply.
We're playing excerpts from an interview Katie Ashby-Coppins did with David Bell, Dr. David Bell, re the 77th World Health Assembly. This excerpt covers IHR amendments.
You've had a chance to go through the international health regulations. There was a fabulous Brownstone article that you have done recently, which gave a breakdown. What are your three biggest takeaways or areas of concern with these international health regulations that you think that we need to get best across so that we can start talking to our politicians and informing the public about?
I think, it's the overall, in the end, it's the disproportionality. So as Robin mentioned, people die of a lot of other things. In terms of infectious disease, almost no one dies of naturally occurring outbreaks. And it's not irrelevant that COVID-19 is very highly likely to be the result of a lab-modified bat virus and not a natural spillover from bats to humans. And that's the discussion in the US Congress at the moment. It looks highly likely that's the case. There's also molecular evidence of that, etc. So the entire pandemic agreement and the international health regulations amendments are geared to finding natural spillovers or passage of viruses from animals to humans. And it appears that COVID is irrelevant to that. So then you go back, well, when was the last one? And, you know, there's a couple of flu outbreaks in the late 50s and 60s that, you know, the one in the 50s was probably a recombination from a bird flu. Then the Spanish flu was a recombination from, you know, partial human, partial bird flu, which happens in influenza. And that was before the era of antibiotics. So we've had over a century without a really big outbreak from that cause. You know, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, that was about less than 4 days of the number of people that died from tuberculosis. The first SARS outbreak was 8 hours of tuberculosis. So people don't die from these in large numbers. It's a tiny impact. And COVID, which was probably not a natural outbreak, that killed people, you know, at an average age of about 80 in most Western countries who are already very sick. It's not irrelevant. Going back to bird flu, as Robin was mentioning, and I think it's H5N2, the current one circulating, but that there is a case that the WHO played up in a press release a few days ago from Mexico. A man died. And he died in late April, and he had been bedbound for some time, 2 or 3 weeks, and then he had chronic renal failure and respiratory illness and diabetes. And unfortunately, he died. And a month later, a sample tested positive on a PCR to bird flu, and when they did sequencing, it was H5N2, and WHO released something saying it's the first human death from bird flu of this particular type. And the Mexican health secretary has come out and said that's not the case. He actually died of his chronic illnesses. And, you know, there are various reasons why a single test a month later can come up positive. There may have been, he may have been exposed through a bird and had a essentially asymptomatic infection. It may have been an extremely mild infection, and that, you know, when you're chronically sick, as we saw in COVID, it just takes a fairly mild virus to tip you over. And that's how most old people die in the end, is with a very mild viral infection that tips them over because they are very, very sick. From other reasons. So we are massively exaggerating a threat of outbreaks and then turning the whole international health system into an industry that deals with that problem. And you know, in the end, even with COVID, whatever the origin, it was more a pandemic of chronic metabolic disease than it was of a virus. Yeah, you know, according to CDC, about 95% of people who died in the US had at least one, and most of them two or three, severe chronic illnesses, mostly around metabolic syndrome, which is your hyperinsulinemia. You end up with diabetes, you're obese, chronic renal failure, etc., cardiovascular disease, and these influence your immune system and your ability to deal with viruses. So it was a pandemic predominantly of these chronic illnesses and a virus, you know, and the inability of a very large part of the population now to deal with fairly mild viral infections because we're eating badly, exercising poorly, etc. And there's a whole industry that's making money off that as well. So it's, you know, we are completely misrepresenting the risk, and that is not only going to divert resources to, you know, the coffers in the end of mRNA vaccine producers and test manufacturers, etc., but it's going to take the emphasis away from what actually harms our health. So this is going to make us all sicker going down this road. It's going to make us poorer, which is also associated, as we know, in public health with early mortality. And you know, it'll make a very small group of people very wealthy. And these people, the wealthier they get, the more power they get, because the more they can buy the regulatory agencies, the politicians, the media, etc. So in the end, the problem with this is that it's setting up essentially a sort of corporate authoritarian system internationally. The further we go down that road, the harder it is to undo. It's the opposite of democracy. It's more a sort of fascist system in its classic sense of corporate authoritarianism than it is a democratic process. And this is what, you know, we hear from the World Economic Forum, stakeholder capitalism, etc., Great Reset. They're not conspiracies. This is what the people behind this whole agenda are talking about openly and publicly, that this is what they want to do. We're not seeing this in the media, which is weird, because it is what these people are saying in public forums. But this is the agenda that we're facing, and the IHR and the ramping up of surveillance, which will feed this whole system, is a very significant part of this. So, you know, what concerns me most is not a particular bit of wording here or there. It's the path that this is taking us further down, which is extremely harmful to democracy, to human rights, and to health.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think has been really useful to get across a lot of the things and have been articulated what you're saying right now is the University of Leeds work and the independent or peer-reviewed material there. And I'll share both of the sort of four-page cheat sheet documents in the trap with Katrina. But let's touch on those a little bit, because they are very important from an independent expert. I dare say, a bit reluctant to use that word nowadays, but independent, peer-reviewed material, which really gets to the nuts and bolts of the issues, which is naturally occurring pandemics are low, you need to be adopting proportionality, and this is going to be costing trillions.
Yeah. So the University of Leeds and now the University of Ghent in Belgium in partnership are just looking systematically at the evidence base around the pandemic agenda internationally and the financing, the governance, etc. And it's not an advocacy group or anything like that. It's just trying to lay out the evidence and so that people could, on any side of this debate, can use it. So we've looked particularly at the World Health Organization's messaging, that of the World Bank and the G20 high-level panel, who were very influential in the lead up to the drafting of the pandemic agreement and the IHR amendments. Yeah, they are using terms like existential threat, exponential increase in outbreaks, etc. You look at the databases on which they are relying and the citations of papers, scientific papers on which they are relying. And these do not back in any way what they're saying. We have from the WHO, you know, we have publications with graphics showing things like yellow fever or cholera, you know, starting since the year 2000 and then continuing, as if all these are suddenly getting worse. I mean, yellow fever, cholera, plague, influenza, which the WHO is saying, you know, is saying in their publications are increasing, becoming exponential threats, etc., you know, existential threats. They were massively worse in the past. 100 years ago, 50 years ago, they were much, much worse than they are now. You know, if you take cholera, the only large outbreak, which is 11,000 deaths in the last 40 years, was in Haiti, and that was caused by poor sanitation in a UN compound. Plague has very small scattered outbreaks. It caused the Black Death in the Middle Ages. That doesn't happen anymore. Influenza, you know, perhaps 20 to 50 million people died in the Spanish flu over 100 years ago, most of them because we didn't have antibiotics. They get secondary infections and they die from staph or strep or other respiratory bacteria that get into lungs that are affected by influenza. Now we have antibiotics. Now that's why we don't see anything like this sort of mortality anymore for flu. So all these are actually decreasing. Things like, you know, the WHO priority disease list, which includes things like MERS, SARS, Crimea, Congo, hemorrhagic fever, etc. And then it has Ebola, which I just mentioned. You know, the largest was just 11,000 people in West Africa. Lassa fever, that is, and it's endemic. It's always been in Africa. It's because of a species of rat that it comes from that lives in Central Africa. The other diseases on that list, none of them have ever in the history of humankind caused more than 1,000 deaths that we know of. So that's why they talk about disease X, which is, you know, that they tout as the next pandemic. The reason they're using disease X, and they actually have it on their priority disease list, is because none of the other diseases that we know are naturally occurring pose enough of a threat to make the case that they're trying to make, that we're in danger from outbreaks. So, but most politicians do not understand this. They assume that the WHO, the World Bank, the high-level independent panel of the G20, which was informed by, you know, groups like McKinsey and Metabiota, which are essentially private groups with very vested interests. They assume that these big organizations, these international organizations, would tell the truth and be objective. And that's not an unreasonable assumption. You know, we just thought that that's how it worked. They haven't caught up with the fact that they are now highly influenced by groups like the World Economic Forum, by the big private financial institutions, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, etc., by pharma, and that there is a revolving door between a lot of these organizations and the private, you know, corporate entities that have no home country, but just purely there to make money for the people who belong to them and for their investors. And they have no other purpose. They have no national good to push. They have no people, you know, population whose welfare is their remit to protect. They are purely there to make money as much as possible, as quickly as possible, for their executives and their shareholders. And they are now the big influencers behind these international organizations, and including the World Health Organization. So the whole way that these organizations work has inevitably changed. We have these public-private partnerships, Gavi, CEPI, etc. The only reason the private part goes into these is because they will get return on investment. They have to. They're private for-profit groups, companies, etc., or private investors who are seeking to make a profit. Their only reason for involvement is to get return. And so this is what is now running the international system and international public health, not the WHO that we used to think was there, which was, you know, run by countries for the good of countries, looking for the biggest disease burdens where they can do something, and with the country's permission, doing it. We're facing a very different international world. And I think most politicians are, it's easier to hide their head in the sand, because if they stick it up and talk about this, they are up against the corporate media that is owned by the same interests. And that's a dangerous thing for them to do.
Now, closing off comments from that interview that Katie Ashby-Coppins did with David Bell, comments on the calamity around the World Health Assembly.
David, do you have a view on the reasons for what I perceive was sort of calamity and chaos and disorganization and, well, it's not the kind of behavior I would consider to be that or conduct of a World Health Organization. Any views that you have for why it might have been a bit haphazard and not as professional looking as it should have looked?
I think there's a lot of pressure on senior levels of the WHO to get this through, partly for reasons of ego, which we all face, and they stake their professional, you know, reputation on it. And partly because there's, you know, powerful sponsors of the WHO and the people they mix with very much want this to happen. I think that it was a lot slower because a lot of the people in the negotiating teams are pretty sensible people who are trying to do the right thing. A lot of them don't understand well the true risks, etc., but some of them do. And so they have been pushing back internally as well. There are people in WHO who see this as a problem. Mm-hmm. It's a very large organization. It still does some important work in some countries. I think overall, it is hard to see it as positive at the moment, but that doesn't mean there are not people within the organization who are sensible and who are trying to do what, to a large extent, the WHO used to do, which was a significant benefit overall. So there is a lot, and I think this is, realization is growing that there is a real problem. The train is running very fast in the wrong direction, but I think there is a growing number of people in the process who are also starting to get concerned that, maybe just taking a salary and going along with it is not really the right thing to do.
You've just heard some excerpts from the interview Katie Ashby-Coppins did with Dr. David Bell a day or so ago regarding the 77th World Health Assembly, where we are at, in his view. And the full interview is available at Vimeo at the Stand Up Australia page.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.